Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Friday, the 29th of July, recording at 9:28 p.m., and that's British Summer Time. Now, this being Friday, this is the big picture long-term outlook for the various asset classes, but first let's have a quick review of the week. In stock markets, well, Asia was the firmest overall, particularly the ASEAN sector. India was the weakest market in Asia, following the surprise 50-point basis rate, 50 basis point interest rate hike at the beginning of the week. And China sector, quiet, mixed. Now, Australia also weakened a bit on the week. European stock markets were mostly lower, as were Wall Street stock markets, and Canada included. Brazil, although Brazil had a little bit of a gain in here today, the U.S. On the S&P has been down five consecutive days. And is currently back, closing today at 1290.92. Now, long-dated government bond prices have been steady to very strong. Gilts have been very strong. Bunds have been strong. U.S. Treasuries were extremely firm in here today, having been steady for most of the week. They rose yesterday and surged today with a 30-year bond up over 2 points here today. More on that in a moment. In terms of bond yields, of course, that means that bond yields were falling. In the European periphery countries, the rates for Portuguese, Spanish, and Italian 10-year bonds all pushed higher and are not all that far off their actual highs to date for the year. Now, precious metals had a quietly steady, well, and there was a bit of uncoupling in here this week. Gold and silver were really quite steady, particularly gold, which hit another new high in here today, and is closing out the week. We're still in after hours trading, but at 16.27. has been as high as 16.32 earlier today, but that's up over $11 today at 16.27. Silver has been fluctuating either side of the $40 level and is currently at 39.86 and a half. Now, platinum was a little weaker, came back under the $1,800 level, 1781, and palladium has been a little bit firmer. Copper's had a good week as well, a good upward dynamic here this week, today I should say today, and we have seen. I beg your pardon. I'll go back to copper. It's been firm. Pretty much all week, but we did not have an upward dynamic here today. Now, cotton showed signs that it may have bottomed out near that $100 level this week. The grain and bean complex started the week steady and then came off a bit, particularly today. Corn, for instance, is down 17 cents today. That's fallen back to $6.68. Crude oil A little bit of respite here this week. Again, it started the week quite firm, and we had WTI up over $99. It's currently at 95.90, and the Brent's come down, having had a look at the 120 levels, come back to 116 and change. Natural gas, that's fallen back here this week, currently $4.15 in the US price, of course. It's much stronger in Europe and elsewhere. Okay, so what's going on here overall? Well, you pretty much know the story because these have been event-driven markets. We've got the European periphery country yield concerns. Those persist. We've had the European Union and the EC minute finance ministers and the ECB get together and come up with another program to try to steady the market, but everyone knows that they're going to have to make some significant strides towards fiscal stability as well. And some people disagree with that and say, well, all they have to do is maintain the rules, but that doesn't quite work with governments, does it? And I think the wiser heads have said all along that we would have to have that fiscal union at some stage, and that stage is now or over the next few years. But that's been weighing on investor sentiment, as you know. And then we've got the U.S. debt ceiling, which has an element of farce to it overall. And we don't yet know how this is going to be resolved, except the one certainty is that they will lift the debt ceiling, but we don't know by how much, and will it be enough to carry on into or beyond the election in November 2012. My guess is probably not, but it really is a guess, and I'm viewing the scene from the remote position on the other side of the Atlantic, remote in terms of Washington, D.C., fortunately. And my hunch is that we will get something that is, well, the surprise, the bullish surprise, would be if they produced the sort of $4 trillion, a plan at any rate, a credible plan for the $4 billion in budget deficit cuts that the rating agencies, S&P, are looking for. Now, are they going to do that? Well, that would be, I think, a pleasant surprise for the markets and also for the US dollar, which has been very weak. I forgot to mention that in my review of the week. It's been very soft. And I think it's more likely that we get some sort of a fudge, which does not satisfy the rating agencies or the markets, in which case that may weigh on these treasury bonds, which have rallied so strongly in here today. And I think we're really very likely to see a U.S. credit downgrade. Now, that's not going to be a disaster by any means, and people have pointed out for some time that Japan's credit rating is double A minus. So what will it mean, though? It's certainly not good news. I don't think it'll have much of an impact at all, although we can't be certain about this. But that's my guess, is that it's unlikely to have much of an impact on a short-term basis. But the difference between Japan and the US is that Japan really owns virtually all of its own debt, and that's not the case with the US. So I think it does mean a higher, longer-term US interest rates at some stage in the future. on any environment other than clear, outright deflation. And we always get deflationary pockets and we get inflationary pockets, as you know. So we can't be overly simplistic about the actual environment that that we have. For instance, we have deflation in wages. We have disinflation in house prices. We've certainly got inflation in commodity prices. And indeed, you could really say that most of the things that households have to pay for every month are moving up in price, and that's the inflation that, that really hurts. So I think the credit downgrade is going to be bearish for bonds, but whoever was buying them today must clearly disagree, because it was a strong market, as I've already mentioned. Be interesting to see what happens next week. Now, as I say, my guess is that they'll fudge the debt ceiling, and but only enough so that it has to be reviewed again at some point next year prior to the election. Now, but I don't expect any huge drama from the markets as a consequence of this. Psychologically, it's a blow, and just another reality check. Another sign that the U.S. cannot rise like the phoenix out of this current economic problem. Not that anybody sensible would have expected that. But what about the markets overall? There's a heck of a difference between the stock market, U.S. stock market, and the economy. U.S. multinational companies are really the upside-down, inverse mirror image of what the government's position looks like. They have strong balance sheets, these companies, and they've got pretty good earnings, although GDP growth today that helped to weigh on the stock market came in weaker than expected for the second quarter. That's old news, of course, but it was only 1.3%. There are questions over the rate of corporate profit gains for the third quarter and for the fourth quarter, and I take a cautious view on that, although some of these companies, a number of these companies, continue to find productivity increases, and not just in laying off labor. Some of it's just continually upgrading their technology, and they're also benefiting. Well, the multinationals, the big multinational ones, are benefiting from the much stronger Asian-led growth that we see. So those companies, again, to repeat myself, they have strong balance sheets. They've had pretty good earnings. They're very attractive. They are fuller money themes. And it's not just the U.S. companies. I would say the same thing about European multinationals that are leveraged to the Asian-led growth economy. And there are a number of them, in particularly in Germany, but also in the UK and some in the other larger economies. And they all have pretty good chart patterns overall. Wall Street, though, and I often talk about the Wall Street leash effect, and while that was positive up till about a week ago, because Wall Street had been rallying from its June low back up to the upper side of the range, NASDAQ 100 index just punched above it and then got clipped with a downward dynamic. So finding resistance from the upper side of the range. I mean, to describe that pattern, we've had, let's take the S&P, we've had a Sisyphusian trading range since February, and the boulder is rolling back down the hill right now. That range has a floor around the 1250 area, and the upper side is in the 1350 region, and has pushed a little bit above that on a couple of the other rallies since February. Now, that's not a bad performance, and the S&P, given some of the concerns weighing on investor sentiment, but the soft U.S. dollar has flattered the performance of Wall Street a little bit. It won't look so good if you calculate it in Australian dollars, for instance. And equally, if you calculate the Australian index, if you look at it in, and you can see charts for these in the library, if you look at it in U.S. dollar terms, the Australian market looks a good deal firmer, not surprisingly. So what's going to happen here? Well, certainly having failed at the upper side of the range, I think a lot of the investors, and particularly traders, say, well, if it can't go up, can't break out on the upside, then we're going to come back and test the lower side of the range. And that happens so often. And I think that's what is underway. Now, any kind of break beneath 1250 that lasted for more than a couple of days would lead to a deterioration in short-term sentiment, in my opinion. That everybody who'd read the textbooks would be saying, oh, look, head and shoulders top in the S&P. And they'll start talking about that fairly soon, I suspect. It would also be edging beneath the rising 200-day moving average, and those important psychologically March and June lows. So the market's in need of some good news to steady investor sentiment here in the short term. Weigh it all up, and the outlook for stock markets is still tricky and with a bit of a bias to the downside. Now, ASEAN markets have been bucking that trend overall. I would expect that when you have a largely ranging environment, as we have had on Wall Street. But if Wall Street takes out those range lows, say that will exert a pull on just about anything else until Wall Street establishes a new bottom or gets a downside failure or whatever happens. But it's going to be a tricky period still. We're still in a corrective phase overall. It's still a difficult time to make money. And I take a cautious view, not so cautious that I want to throw out positions that I like holding for the long term. And I'm still waiting to invest some additional cash. And these setbacks, of course, improve valuations somewhat, despite the slower growth that we're seeing generally. And there are, as you know, a number of attractive shares overall, particularly among the multinational companies, some of the dividend aristocrats that Owen is constantly reviewing. He's got another terrific review here today covering the FTS, the more interesting looking FTSE 100 index components, or some of them. And there are some attractive dividends in equities around the globe. So I don't think this is a time to be despondent at all from an investor perspective. But the chances are we're going to see markets looking a bit shaky here for a while longer. Now, that's not such good news if you're watching the bottom line valuation on your equity portfolio. It is good news if you've got some reasonable amounts of cash on hand that you're looking forward to investing in equities. And I think equities are much, much more interesting than corporate bonds. I would, if I had bonds, I would rather have bonds of quality in terms of balance sheet, multinational companies, than government bonds, certainly than Western government bonds. And I would rather have equities than good corporate bonds. Now, what else to mention? Precious metals. Very steady action, of course, in gold. Again, this week, quietly steady, but nudging up there and hitting a couple of new highs here this week in U.S. dollar terms. At any rate, there is a risk if we get some convulsive activity in markets around the debt ceiling news, and then we've got the rollover of the futures contracts for gold as the September contract expires. And so I think it would be surprising not to see a little bit of turbulence. I'm playing it quite cautiously and put in some tight stops on my leveraged positions. I don't think the turbulence is something that those who are holding gold bullion need to worry about one bit. We've got a market that's very steady ahead of its cyclically stronger period. The consistency pattern that we've seen with gold bullion over the last decade, it's not going to go on forever, but it looks like it's on target here for a good fourth quarter of the year and carrying on into the new year. Now, when I say that won't go on forever, what would actually change it significantly? And one factor would be if we were to see a major blow-off acceleration to the upside. Well, we obviously haven't seen anything like that yet, but I do expect that at some stage, because these secular bull markets usually do end in a mania phase. We don't have anything like a mania phase in gold. We kind of had a mini mania phase in silver. You get that in the cycle. We had that for platinum as well a few years ago, and the strike was on in South Africa, and the price chart went parabolic, and then of course it falls back quite sharply before finding support once again within its secular bull run. But I think the potential for a significant move to the upside is definitely there. What will eventually, to answer my own question, what will eventually kill off this bull market will be higher interest rates. And that's what's always done it. I've been saying, and Owen and I've been saying for a decade, that gold is being steadily remonetized in the eyes of investors. And people want to have gold, and understandably and rightly so. And then you've got silver, which is basically, we always describe that as high beta gold. So in the really bullish phases, silver will almost always go up a bit more, and it'll fall much more sharply when the market comes down. Platinum and palladium. Now we've got this miners' strike in South Africa, and that may well lead to firmer prices over the next few weeks. Certainly a protracted strike would do so, and that could be particularly bullish for platinum. But currently, investors really are in two minds as to whether platinum is mostly a precious metal or mostly an industrial metal. And my answer to that, it is most definitely a precious metal, as is palladium, but they do have major industrial uses, not least in the catalytic converters. So for people to get really enthusiastic about platinum and palladium, you have to have either a supply shortage and a strong automobile sector. And if you have both, then they're going to take off. Palladium has the better chart pattern overall, and I would not be at all surprised to see both of them move higher in that 6-month period. a 7 month period from starting in September and running through the first quarter of 2012. But probably with Palladium getting an even bigger move overall. Palladium, incidentally, is not affected by that South African mining strike to any great degree, as most of it comes from Russia, or at least half of it. I think it's well over half of it. But don't hold my feet to the fire on that comment. Now, in terms of most of the production coming from Russia, crude oil. This is the elephant in the room, and it's backed off, given us a little bit of respite in here, but prices are still uncomfortably high. The supply situation is uncomfortably tight, with the Libyan production being down, and we're not going to see any. I'd be surprised if we saw any oil exports of significance from Libya for at least a year. But you know, Gaddafi will have to be out of there, and the civil war will have to have ceased before we get foreign technicians moving back in there and assessing and repairing the damage that has taken place to the oil installations, particularly to the export facilities. So this is a tight supply demand situation, and it's one that I forecast will be tight throughout this decade and possibly a little bit longer. And then we should, on our projections at any rate, get into a much more attractive environment for energy overall, when most of the countries of the world have fully embraced the technology for shale gas and shale oil, and that technology is improving all the time. And yes, indeed, there are environmental concerns, and I don't think there'll be too much development of the shale properties that sit above or below crucial aquifers, for instance, and that's understandable and sensible, but it's the supply is very plentiful, and it can be extracted reasonably cheaply, which is a big bonus. For instance, shale oil, for the most part, can be extracted much, much more cheaply than some of those exceedingly expensive and risky deep water drilling projects. So eventually, I think we will be in an environment where, as Owen and I are on record as saying, you know, 12 to 15 years from now, we feel that the price of oil and gas will be lower than it is today in real terms. Now, I'll take European gas prices and European oil prices for that, because the WTI is not, or the natural gas contract in the U.S. is not reflective of what is happening on a global basis. Gas costs much more in Europe, for instance, and WTI is a much better benchmark for what most oil importing countries, I beg your pardon, the Brent is a much better benchmark for in terms of what most of the oil importing countries are actually paying for their crude oil. So I do feel, to say, that in real inflation adjusted terms, 12 to 15 years from now, that oil and gas will cost less than their European counterparts today, in real inflation-adjusted terms, thanks to the very abundant supplies of both shale oil and shale gas. But we're a long way from that at this time, and this decade's problem, one of them, at any rate, in addition to just the very, very slow recovery among Western economies, following the credit crunch an insolvency crisis. So we've got that that lingering, ongoing problem, plus also the tight energy supply situation. And commodity inflation is going to be a problem throughout this decade. It will be mitigated somewhat by slowdowns and recessions. And it takes a very big recession, I think, to bring prices back down sharply, but they bound back upwards quickly, as we have actually seen since those 2008 lows become a problem again. So, but there will be opportunities in commodities on numerous occasions, and it's an area in which we very much wish to remain interested. And Fuller Money themes overall, whether it's the Western multinational companies that are leveraged to the Asian-led growth economies, those Asian-led opportunities in those Asian-led growth economies and the resources producing, exporting economies, there'll be lots of opportunities for equity market appreciation over the next decade, I'm sure. But I'm not expecting runaway bull markets in the near term. I think this turbulent picture continues for a while longer. And if it results in a bit of capitulation, that will create a good buying opportunity. And I don't want this audio to go on torturously long period. It's gone on quite long enough. So I'll just wish you all an absolutely splendid weekend. All the best.